couple of seconds. He's one of the persons who was instrumental in the early civil rights movement in the South. He's from Nashville, Tennessee. He's a former member of SNCC. He's currently a writer. He's also has a weekly news, a radio program in New York City, which has been in the height of controversy. He's recently published Look Out Whitey, Black Power's Gonna Get Your Mama, and most recently The Slave. Currently he's working on 4 other works to be released within the year. Mr. Julius Lester.
I'm really not sure, you know, what I want to talk about tonight. One thing which I don't like is, I don't like it less and less, is being in front of a crowd of people, because it puts you in the position of appearing to be something that you aren't, which is a leader. And I'm not that. You know, I'm one individual who has some particular experiences. From those experiences, I have certain ideas. And so I've come way the hell out here to Illinois to share those ideas as best I can. And when I say share, that's what I mean, that I don't have the answers. I have some answers, which may be all wrong. So that what I'd really like to do tonight is for us to talk to each other. See, I think that one of the things which the black movement in particular has suffered from has been an epidemic of leaders, an epidemic of people who are forceful, charismatic, and what have you, and people who were going to lead us to the promised land, and we still here. And the only way we're going to get to the promised land is to start off walking down the road ourselves. And if the brother in front ain't doing what he's supposed to do, then you push him on to the back. I think an example of what I'm talking about in terms of leadership and the current issue of Life magazine. See these fools going to the moon in that damn thing. There's an article about San Fernando Valley State College in California. And the article focuses on a brother by the name of Wayso. And it's filled with, you know, pictures of the brother and all sorts of things like that. And I think it's very, very sad. See, America's a country which is hung up on individualism. That, I guess the perfect example of what I'm talking about is the fact that Eldridge Cleaver's latest book has his picture on the cover. And the title of the book is Eldridge Cleaver. Now, you know, I know that the brother didn't have anything to do with that. I'm not criticizing the brother. But this is the way the man thinks. And so what he's done is that he's turned Eldridge into a commodity, which he is selling out there. And as far as I'm concerned, as a black person, well, Eldridge Cleaver is a name like any other name. And if what I'm concerned about are the concepts which the brother is supposed to be articulating. And that's what the focus is going to be on. But the book is going to sell like mad because, you know, like he's the closest thing we got to a black Che. And folks get hung up behind that for some reason. The romantic image and all that. And that, you know, one other thing which the whole thing of having leaders does to us is that we begin to sit back and wait for the leader to do everything. That you begin to get the impression, really, that the revolution is going to be fought on Huntley Brinkley and not in the minds of people and not in the streets and every place else where it's going to be fought. And so at a certain point, it seems that leaders become a block, a detriment. They get into a position where, without realizing it, they're holding people back. Now, at the same time, this is not to say that you can't have, you don't need leadership. But see, I make a very clear distinction between leaders and leadership. Because one is dealing with individuals. A particular individual. The other is dealing with concepts. What is to be done, how it is to be done. Every movement, of course, has its symbol. Cuba has Fidel. China has the good chairman. North Vietnam has Ho. But that what has happened is that that's not all that China, North Vietnam, and Cuba have. So that in terms of the black movement, I feel that because leaders were projected, certain expectations were created. And these expectations have not been fulfilled. Because at the present moment, there is a vacuum of leadership. There is no organization. I mean, if you see three black folks walking down the street, it's probably an organization. I mean, that's just true. I mean, in Harlem in 1964, there were 47 black radical organizations. Them were the radical. Now, how many, you know, Uncle Toms and conservatives, you know, and hustlers there were? Nobody bothered to count. So I know by this time there's at least 200. Each one quoting Malcolm. All of them got to quote Malcolm. Malcolm liked the Bible now. You know how the old folks used to be. You know, you ought to brush your teeth, cause in Revelations 3, verse 6. The dragon comes out of your mouth. You know? So that nowadays, you know, everybody has to quote Malcolm. Anything he wants, if he wants to shoot white folks, quote Malcolm. If he wants to love white folks, he quote Malcolm. Anything he wants to do, quote Malcolm. And obviously, you know, with all these organizations, the black community is, of course, getting left out completely. All these organizations, you know, I mean, we're in the age of blackness. No, I'm blacker than you. No, man, I'm blacker than you. Man, I said, I'm blacker than you. Then, you know, they go to war over who's gonna be the blackest. You know, meanwhile, the man is sitting over there, you know, kind of egging it on, man. If he said, you know, he said, man, that you was great. He said you wasn't black, Jim. So they fight over it and all this, you know. And everybody's talking about they black. And, you know, like everybody said that black is beautiful. As if that was something new. That wasn't nothing new. You know, folks just realized that black always been beautiful. Man, you late, that's all. I mean, folks in Africa knew black was beautiful since year one. So you have found it out. Okay, that's cool. But that no one has defined what that blackness means. See, that's very dangerous, because if you don't define what you are, then it makes it very, very possible for the man to come along and define what you are. The man defines what you are, and then you spend all your time arguing with the man's definition. And so he has you in that eternal trap of reacting to him. Instead, of course, the reverse. Him reacting to us. This afternoon I told a story, which I think I'll repeat about before I get into that, I'll get to that in a minute. We demand of any black person who is foolish enough to stick himself behind a microphone in front of a group of people, we demand that he talk black. And because we do not have a clear concept in our minds of what blackness means, not only culturally and psychologically, but most importantly, politically, it means that you can get a variety of opinions coming out under the umbrella of blackness. So that the biggest Uncle Tom is generally the one who's being the blackest, the loudest, and the proudest. The biggest Uncle Tom might be the cat with the 8-foot-high afro and the dashiki that Jomo Kenyatta's grandmama made. But that because the cat is black, we don't challenge that. He's black, and that's enough. Then as black people, of course, you see, and I talked about this afternoon to the few people who were there, as black people, we have one weakness, which might be a fatal weakness. I'm not sure. Which is that the weakness for rhetoric. The weakness for the brother who can talk that talk. And that, you know, I mean, we come by it naturally, see, because we grow up and we go to church. Now, you know when you go to church what the man gonna talk about. God, Jesus, heaven, hell, and sin. That's what he gonna talk about. Every Sunday, 52 Sundays a year, 52 years, long as he lives, he ain't gonna vary the message. But we go there to hear how he talks about it. Lord, child, you know Reverend so-and-so sure can preach on it. He can make you walk benches and get happy. And that's a whole thing in itself, see, which is not necessarily bad. But it becomes bad when we extend it over into the political arena. Because, see, what happens to a black cat who suddenly finds himself in a position of being a leader? He starts role-playing. I've sat on, you know, platforms with black leaders. And like one cat will get up, Jim, and he will blow. I mean, he will talk about white folks like a dog, Jim. Have folks rolling in the eye, because he's funny with his stuff, too. Just running it down. Meanwhile, the star, you know, the big leader, he's sitting over here scared to death. Man, I got to work tonight, man, to beat that Jim. Oh, that brother, I don't know what I'm going to do, man. So by the time his time come, all he concerned about is performing. He ain't concerned about educating people, getting the folks' minds, preparing the minds as a tool for battle. Guess what the mind is? Tool for battle. He concerned about getting that applause and getting them laughs, and so the folks will forget what the other dude did. And that I think that it's past time, you know, for us to accept that. I think about Dr. King a lot. And I remember, you know, last year when Dr. King was murdered, they played his March on Washington speech on radio and TV all the time, you know. And, you know, I'm supposed to be intelligent. And I found out, you know, how far I had to go. Because I'd sit there and I'd listen to that speech. And I'd say, Lord, have mercy. And that man can talk. Let freedom ring. And then when he got on to, and at the funeral, when he talked about, tell him I've been a drum major for justice. That man can talk. And I heard that March on Washington speech over and over and over. And then finally one day it hit me. What did he say? Well, he said, let freedom ring. Okay, that's cool. That's like saying, let the milkman come. All right, I get that. Then he said, I have a dream. You know, well, I dream every night. You know, well, that's cool. You know, I don't dream about eating with no cracker from George at the same table, but that's all right. You know, every man his own dreams, you know. Can't knock a cat's dreams. But that here the man was quarter of a million people out there, nationwide TV. He ain't run down no program. He ain't talking about nothing about how he was gonna let freedom ring. He said, let it ring. He ain't said nothing about how his dream was gonna come about. And yet, that was a great speech, we said. Because he had the style. See, that style thing, boy, good God Almighty, did we get hung up in style. And so, like, we have to begin checking ourselves. Because after all, our leaders are responsible, supposedly, to us. But they will only be responsible to us if we demand certain things of him. See, this brother Wazo that I was talking about who was in here, I hope that the brothers at the college jack him up for letting Life magazine come and take photographs of him and do an article on him. They should really jack him up as high as they can jack him. Because what the article should have been about were the programs and the concepts the black students were trying to get across. Not about this one individual who is no more important than any other black person in this country. You know, I think one of the first things which you gotta do if you want to be worthy of that name revolutionary is to start working on your ego. That ego is a terrible thing, boy. Because ego can make you forget that black people ever existed. can make you forget what the struggle is supposed to be about. Ego can also get you in a whole lot of trouble, too. Because see, once them TV cameras start pointing at you and reporters start asking you questions, you know, and all that kind of stuff, Jim, you know, well, that means that the FBI takes your file out of the folder and puts it on somebody's desk. You know, and then after a while, they're going to start following you around. And you end up in unable to do anything. Because you've been projected as a leader. Back in 1966, and I think one of the perfect examples, I mean, is the perfect example of the, to my mind, of the weakness for rhetoric, and has a lot of other implications. I was in SNCC. And for, you know, several months, people in SNCC had been going around talking about powerful black people, powerful black people. Brother used to be in SNCC by the name of Willie Ricks. And, you know, Ricks is a good brother who has that way of putting the words together. So on the Meredith March in Mississippi, instead of saying powerful black people, Ricks jumped up and said black power. Now, well, you know, black power meant power for black people. That's all he meant. But immediately, the press, of course, runs to Stokely and says, Mr. Carmichael, what is black power? You know, Stokely didn't know what black power was. Black power was power for black people. You know, yeah, you know, what was Rick's talking about? He didn't know. Well, black power is blah, 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 blah. Never once inside SNCC did we discuss what is black power? What does it mean politically, socially, economically, culturally, internationally? How does it relate to this, that, and the other? There were about 40 people in SNCC, and there were about 40 different definitions of black power. Because we all could talk, we all could improvise. Mr. Lester, what's black power? Well, black power is blah, 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 blah. You know, like if you couldn't improvise, the stock answer was, well, black power is for black people. We don't discuss it with the black, with the white press. That was, you know, that was the perfect answer, you know. And so, you know, really black power was, it took SNCC by surprise. I mean, it really did. And I don't think SNCC ever recovered. I mean, we haven't figured out yet quite what happened. Next thing we knew, you know, Stokely was on the front pages and SNCC was in the headlines. And when we went around, you know, folks was following us that we didn't know and they wasn't good looking, you know, so we figured something was wrong. And so what happened, because we did not have a clear concept of black power and a clear program of black power, that meant that black people around the country did the same thing that we did. Yeah, well, baby, you know what black power is. Black power is, well, you know, man, black power is, you know. Black people say, you know, anytime they don't know, they throw in, you know, about 15 times, you know. And, man, you know, like, Wretched of the Earth, man, well, that's a book about, you know, man, it's a book about revolution, man, you know. Yeah, I know. Ain't no communication going on because the cat's black and because you black, well, you don't want to let him know that you don't know and he don't want to let you that he don't know. And so, you know, ignorance marches forth, you know, with black fists thrust in the air. Here we come. And but we don't know what we're talking about to each other. We know on a vague, instinctual level. We kind of feel the same vibrations. But like social movements don't move on vibrations. Social movements moved by hard work toward very clear, very well-defined goals. So SNCC unleashes all this fantastic black energy around this thing called black power. Because there were no programs, because there wasn't the organization that could have been to have concretized this black power, our flank was left uncovered. And the man, being very, very together, which the man is, could... What's going on in there? The man, being very together, could move in from the rear, provide the programs and the plan and the framework, all under the guise of black power. And that's what's happened. I was walking down Broadway in New York the other day, and I looked in the store window, and I saw this men's cologne. And I looked at it, and it had a dude on it with a natural. And the name of the cologne was Black and Proud, Men's Cologne. So I said, well, it's, I don't know what I'm going to be now, Jim, but it's time to move on from being black. Got to be something else. I mean, I picked up Ebony magazine, and Ebony magazine had an ad on page 2. This brother with, you know, one of them treetop high afros and a dashiki and a 50 caliber machine gun bullet on a rawhide strand around his neck. And he was looking bad, you know. Talking about Newport cigarettes. You know, and I look at that and I think, is that what all those black people in Detroit died for when they got in the streets? Is that what all them black folks in Watts died for when they jumped in the streets? So some jive black actor could make $25 an hour talking about Newport cigarettes? Then I turn on my TV set. Oh, wow. Black folks talking about V8 juice. Black folks arguing over whether mint-flavored Crest is better than regular-flavored Crest. And they got black folks on there talking about Dodge. And O.J. Simpson just signed a contract with Chevrolet. And then, of course, there's Junior. And then there's Mod Squad. Then there's that nigga Cowboy. I ain't figured out yet what he doing. But he out there, you know, playing Lone Ranger, riding across the plains and all that stuff, you know. And I say, is that what it was all about? I mean, too many black people lost their lives for this to be the result. And yet, it could only be the result because there was a vacuum of leadership within the black movement. There was no vacuum of leaders, but there was a vacuum of leadership. Now the question comes about, see, that okay, there's been agitation on college campuses by black students. And every time you get up the paper, you know, colleges I never heard of, you know, they got black students at them now. I don't know how the black students found these schools, you know. I'm serious. You know, I don't know how they found these schools, but they found them. And if they got, you know, like college got 26,000 students, and they got 4 black students, and the 4 black students immobilized the university for 2 weeks. You know, and present a list of 152 demands, you know, and stuff, you know. Okay, you know, I don't quite know what's going on, but, you know, it's all right. I don't care. Up in Canada, you know, you didn't leave that black folks in Canada. Can you believe that, man? They're the descendants of the slaves who went there on the Underground Railroad. And, you know, there's only about 7 or 8 of them up there, you know. But they took over the computer center at Sir George Williams University in Montreal. And I was supposed to go up there and speak, and I was glad it snowed in New York, like 15 inches, and I was so happy, boy, because I didn't want to go up there and all that mess, getting all that trouble up there. Because what they did was they wrecked the man's computer center. They just tore computers off the wall and just tore up the man's poor computers, you know, and then set the place on fire, you know. And that happened the night I was supposed to speak, you know, and I was just so glad that I was sitting at home. I really was. And I say, okay, you know, all this is going on black campuses, and black students want black studies. Okay, what they mean by black studies? See, Harvard University has announced, dig it, Harvard University announced that they were setting up a degree program in black studies. Well, if Harvard University announces something like that, then, you know, it's going to be Harvard's version of black studies. And you talk about black studies, then, you know, like there's C. Van Woodard, he got ideas on it, and John Hope Franklin. And, you know, you can have radical black studies. You can have, you know, Uncle Tom black studies. You can have good old red, white, and blue black studies, you know. From what point of view is that black studies going to be taught? That is the question. And then I was up at Connecticut College, which is, you know, sure enough up there in Eskimo land, you know, but some black folks got up there somehow. And they said, well, you know, we agitated for black studies program, and we got it. And there's a, thank you, there's a white professor teaching it. What shall we do? Weep. That's what I told them. Go home and cry. Didn't you, fool? Didn't you think of that ahead of time? So I think the first consideration is, what's going to be the point of this black studies program? If the point of it is going to be so brother can get a degree in black studies so he can try to pull down one of them good paying jobs in Harvard's black studies department, then we don't need it. The only real function which any black studies program can have is to train black students in such a way that they can take what they know back home. Now see, college is a very funny thing, but college is very dangerous, it really is. I was talking to a young sister whom I knew in Atlanta. She finished college last June. She went back home to Jacksonville, Florida. And I saw her a couple of weeks ago, and she said, you know something? I can't relate to the people at home no more. And I said, yeah, I know. College does that to you if you don't watch out. That you go back home and that you find it's not as easy to talk to mama, and it's easy to talk to daddy. And then you go down the street and you see, you know, Bubba and Booshine and Big Red and Little John that you used to hang out with, you can't talk to them no more. And if that happens, well, from the man's point of view, college has been successful because he has separated you from your community. And so therefore, you know, like you hang around for a while and you can't relate to the people you once could relate to, and so you end up back in grad school. You run back to where you can relate to people, where people talk your language. So you stay in grad school and get one of them, you know, one of them some old letters, and then you get a job at a college because you got enough letters behind your name, then you stay in that college, and that's it. And it's direct analogy to what happens to African students. African students go to Paris to study at the Sorbonne and the Université and all that mess, you know. And I met so many Africans in Paris and in Sweden who had come there to study, had gotten their degrees, been out of school 8 years, and I said, well, when you going back home? Well, I'm going back home next summer. Dude's been gone 10 years, Jim. You know he ain't going home. He's sitting around past smoking that hash. That's right, boy. It's all over the world, boy. Man, you find a black person, 9 times out of 10, you scold. You know that. You can like that or not like it if you want to, but it's true. But that the same thing happens in this country. Because we come out of a strange country called Afro-America. And we don't travel over no ocean. But we travel, you know, a few miles from home into a weird, strange environment. I mean, you know, like I'm 30 years old and, you know, I thought I was rather sophisticated. And then they had me eat on campus today. And that was a cultural shock. I mean, that was a cultural shock. And all I could do was sit there and mutter to myself, you know, and I was really freaking out. And, you know, like, I asked one of the brothers, I said, man, y'all must smoke a lot around here, Jim, because that's the only way I could deal with this, you know. And he said, that's right. You know? I mean, that's just true. And so the first thing you got to understand is how dangerous it is to be here. Okay, there's a program here where brothers and sisters, you know, are coming in from the community. All right, then I think the first priority of the Black Student Organization is to set up definite programs and orientation sessions and what have you to get those brothers and sisters through that first year. And if that means tutoring, what have you, letting the brother come cry on your shoulder, whatever it means. It's very, very necessary. Very, very necessary. Because every black person who comes into this university from a high school is the responsibility of the black students who are already here. Because this is one of our own coming. And it's because of our agitation and our demands that he's here. So when the brother gets here, we can't leave him strung out. Got to look after him. But see, everybody who uses that word brother, like when you say the word brother, when you say the word sister, you should feel a strange tingle. You know, at least I do, because I mean, I'm weird though. But you should feel something when you say that word. You should really feel it. You should feel a little bit warm. That, yeah, this cat is my brother. And his name is irrelevant. And that I have to do whatever I can and look out for him. So you come here. Now, one thing which I get very, very afraid of course, is that people who come here, blacks who come here, when senior year comes around and all them recruiters come on campus, you know, the CIA, recruits. Nah, that's right, man. Big sign out there, join the CIA, you know, be like Bill Cosby, you know, and all that kind of thing, you know. And all them recruiters come, that you might yield to the temptation. That's okay. See, I mean, that may not be bad, because, see, all right, you got to work. Got to make some bread to pay them bills, you know, and do whatever else you're going to do with that money. We know what that is, but that's something else again. Got to get that job. But it has to be a job to you, not your life's work. I see the man is fantastic. I know a brother who was working for IBM. He was drafted IBM wants this brother so bad that IBM is paying this brother a weekly salary while he's in the army. So, you know, IBM done bought themselves a nigger. That's right, because he ain't gonna never leave IBM, Jim. Well, man, when I was in the army, man, IBM sent my check every week, man. Those are good white folks, you know. That's it. But that, the one question which I think has to be in everybody's mind as they go through any university is, how am I going to use what I'm getting here in the black community? That's not an easy question to answer. Because, see, we have a tendency sometimes, see, to romanticize the black community. We get caught up in that bag. Romanticizing the brother on the block. I think one of the prime examples of that romanticization is this whole soul food thing. Because, see, black folks eat the food they eat because they can't afford nothing else. When I was growing up, we didn't call it soul food. It was food. That's what it was. Long about 3 years ago, the black middle class started feeling guilty about having left black community behind and all that. So to make themselves feel good and to help themselves get back to where they came from, they talk about soul food. I never will forget about 1962, after I got married, I went to the store with my wife. And instead of stopping at the fried chicken, she went on down to the steak. And, you know, I'd heard about steak. I ain't exaggerating. I'd heard about steak, you know. But, like, I never had no steak. Then I got on there, boy, and I saw that they got sirloin steak. They got London broil. And they got chuck steak. They got shellfish steak. I never figured out what that was. I'm scared to buy that one. You know, I still ain't had none of that, you know. They got about, you know, 17 kinds of steaks there. And man, I went wild. Because this was belly food. You know, and soul food, I don't know whether I'm making myself clear. See, I'm not putting down soul food. I'm saying don't romanticize it. That neck bones is neck bones. Pig feet are pig feet, Jim. And they may be good for the soul, but I don't like black children growing up on neck bones and pig feet and nothing else. Them children need some sure enough food. And bacon ends. Oh, Jim, bacon ends. Don't tell me about no soul food, man. I ain't ate bacon ends, boy. Feel like a pig myself, man. And I don't know, you know, bacon ends as compared to bacon, Jim. That's, whew. You ever ate pure fat? That's bacon ends, man. Pure fat with, you know, like just an eyelash of meat on it. That's bacon ends. And so that we gotta be very careful not to romanticize the black community out of reality. And the reason that we romanticize it is to overcome our own alienation from it. But let's, you know, let's see it like it is. Ain't nothing romantic about Harlem. Not a damn thing romantic about Harlem. Now, it seems to me that perhaps the number one priority in terms of need inside the black community is in terms of education, is in terms of going back home and teach in school. Because that's our future, them children. That's our future. And that since there are more black students in college than ever before, and more gonna be coming out, that means that the black community is developing the skills and the expertise to do a particular job in the community. And that I think we have to recognize that the only reason that we're in school on other folks' backs. And I don't think we can forget that. You know, I know that a lot of your mamas and your daddies out there scrubbing the floors. So they can send you, you know, $10 a week, $20 a week, or whatever, because they want you to get that degree. They proud because you're down here. It's not an easy question to answer. But I think it's the only, you know, relevant question to answer. Can't study in medicine. Okay. I recognize that if a cat studies medicine, he got all sorts of expenses involved in setting up his office and all that. Fine. He can have his fashionable office and all of that and make his money as long as he uses that money to go down on Hastings Street or wherever, rent him a little storefront. And do some doctoring. And, you know, not worry about whether or not he's getting, you know, what he considers the proper pay for. Because, I mean, the black community lacks good doctors. That's just a fact, you know that. I mean, the black community still has a high infant mortality rate. It's not only from lack of doctors, but from, you know, living conditions. And so, see, I mean, like some cats would run down a hard line on you about if you revolutionary and you got to go into the community and give up this and give up the other and all that. Well, I don't run no hard lines, see. I'll try to make it easy as possible. You know, you can do your gig. But just recognize that, you know, the bread you're getting from it and all that, there should be some way in which you and some other cats can pool that bread and do something in the community. Because you're the hope. See, you're the hope. A lot depends upon what this generation of black students does. Now, I think, you know, that the black community is gradually entering a phase of well, what I would term as ideological conflict. Because you see, the man's on the offensive. He's definitely on the offensive. And he's pushing his whole black capitalism program. And that he's replacing his white administrators of the black colony with black administrators of the black colony. Which sets up the possibility for intense conflict within the black community. Because what he's seeking to do is that he realized during the rebellions where the reason black people are burning down their neighborhoods is because they feel like neighborhoods don't belong to them. So let this cat own, let the black cat own the store instead of the white cat. The black cat own the store, and rebellion come, then I know the black cat will be standing in the door of his store with a shotgun. And, you know, which comes back to, you know, what I was trying to say before about, you know, blackness not being enough. I think that that we're facing a political situation where there are going to be more and more black mayors. And of course, these black mayors are going to be responsive not to the needs of black people, but to the needs of the Democratic Party. And I think it's obvious that there's no relationship between the needs of black people and the needs of the Democratic Party. I hope that's obvious. So that we're going to be in the position where we're going to find that our enemy is not necessarily defined by color, but is defined by ideology. And see, when I say enemy, see, don't get that confused with who you don't like. See, you may not like white folks. That don't mean white folks is your enemy. And I think a lot of people get that confused. A lot of people go around talking blackness when what they're saying is, I hate white people. I mean, I know some black people that if they woke up in the morning and all white folks had disappeared from the face of the earth, by noon they would have had me, by noon they would have invented some more white folks. Because they need them. I guess the last thing I want to say, I sure hadn't planned to do all this talking again. Damn. Last thing I want to say is that I think it's very important that we understand that what we're involved in, those of us who identify with that word revolution, that the revolutionary process is a very long process. And I emphasize the word process. See, revolution, see, words are very bad, especially when they're printed. Because it looks like a thing, revolution. And you think of revolution and you think of, you know, people waving banners and shooting guns and, you know, like, you know, marching into Washington, D.C., you know, and this kind of thing and taking over, you know, and that's revolution. That ain't revolution. Revolution is a process, a very long historical process. And that process is only lengthened if each generation does not do all that it is capable of doing. See, if you are filled with all them romantic dreams like I am of the triumphant revolutionary forces marching into Washington, D.C. and marching up to the White House and tearing down the fence and all that, you know, well, you can join me in the crazy house because, you know, it ain't gonna happen in our lifetime. I remember when my little girl was born, we got in the car and I took her up Lenox Avenue, Jim. Showed her where she was gonna lead the revolutionary forces, up Lenox Avenue, you know. Yeah, I get out there sometime, boy, I really do. But you know, I realized that you know, that it ain't gonna be like that. And I'm glad I came to my senses and realized that. Because then that means that, you know, you get on to serious work. You realize, you know, that people only turn to revolution as an answer when everything else has been exhausted. Okay, this country's going to do some very slick things. It's going to reform the draft. It's going to eventually give 18-year-olds the vote. And it's eventually going to enact some kind of guaranteed annual wage. Okay, well, that takes care of a whole lot of stuff. Because with 18-year-olds voting and 18-year-olds, you know, that means that whole youth block is going to feel it has a stake in the system because it can vote. The draft won't be as threatening. Poor people to be pacified by that guaranteed annual wage for a little while. So the struggle is going to get that much harder, that much longer, that much more intense. And I've seen it happen. People becoming very, very bitter and very, very discouraged. Because when you're young, you know, you want to see your hopes realized. And that I don't want that to happen to any of us. You know that, I mean, we might not even be a footnote in the history book. Which is all right. But we have a very definite job to do. If we don't do that job, then that's going to retard that historical process. And it's going to put that day when the possibility of humanity existing in this country, it's going to put that day much further off. The black community exists in a state of anguish crying because there's so many needs to be filled. And there is no individual who cannot use his talents in relationship to those needs. We've been deceived by people telling us that revolution meant the gun, instead of telling us that one of the things revolution means is the gun. But everybody in a revolution doesn't fire a gun. Everybody in a revolution doesn't even get near a gun. Somebody got to worry about shoelaces. A lot of things going on in revolution. The gun is only one of them. So that I really hope that what has been started here among the black students at the University of Illinois, which has begun to bear some fruit here at the university, we'll see a continual blooming all across black America. A blooming that will begin to relate to the concrete needs of people. Because while, you know, we sit here, the rat's on the prowl. The roaches coming out from the walls. And that if we forget about that, then we've betrayed our people. Sometimes it's very, very hard, see. But because it's hard, is no reason that you shouldn't try. And it's like Chairman Mao says, you know, the people try and the people fail. The people try and the people fail. But the people move forward. Thank you. I don't know what people want to do. I don't know what do you think.
You can use it as a kind of a talk, sir.